Okay. So, Baruch Hashem, we've made it to the second half of Kislev. I believe this was the first day where my wife and I said, should we put winter coats on our kids today when we send them? So it's officially that point in the year in Israel. Like hot drinks become less of a like trendy thing and more of a necessity. Soup can be eaten in multiple meals a day now, not just like a Friday night thing. So we're in it. We've made it into the middle of the winter, and it's specifically now where it's interesting because until now you wear like maybe a sweater, maybe a something, but now we really focus on warming ourselves up because it's getting cold enough that we need to actually put thought in the beginning of our day of how to keep warm. And it is fitting that right as we transition into, okay, now we have to really make sure to keep warm. So as it is in the physical world, so too it is in the spiritual world. So this is a period of the year where we actively look for ways to keep warm, to get the warmth of spirituality, of having a kesher with Hashem. We look for ways to strengthen that, to further develop that, to maintain that, and everywhere we can. And Baruch Hashem, we're at not just a specific period of time, but really even a 24-hour period of Yat Kislev, Yud Tes Kislev, which has several different names. It's called Rosh Hashanah L'Chassidus. There's a paper right there. Yeah. It is called Chag HaGe'ulah also. And for those, just to refresh everyone, to remind everyone, it's essentially three things that happened, one of them being the most famous, but the most famous being that the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the founder of Chabad, the Baal HaTanya, Rav Schneur Zalman from Liadi, so he was imprisoned by the Russian army. They thought he was trying to sponsor the enemies of Russia to fight against them, and it was found to actually be not completely true, but he wasn't a fan. And he was imprisoned, and at this very day he was released from prison, and he saw that as a tremendous rebirth, not only for himself, but for what he was going to bring into the world and what he was able to bring to the world ultimately. This is also the day that commemorates the publishing of his Sefer called Tanya. And this is also the yahrzeit of his Rebbe, the Magid Mimezrich, who was the Talmud, the chief Talmud of the Baal Shem Tov, allowed the Baal HaTanya to spread Chassidus into Russia and eventually into Poland and eventually where we're standing right now. So that's a big deal, and it's important to acknowledge that, understand what is the real significance of this day. Yesterday at Mincha, when I was davening here at Bar Ilan, for some reason the Shlich Tzibur went straight into Kaddish after Shmona Esrei, and he looked around and was like, what are you doing? But he just continued because he was like confused. You know when you're confused when you're Shlich Tzibur, guys, you know what I'm talking about? And you just like keep going because you don't know if you messed up or if you have to stop. So he did one of those things, but it was clear to me afterwards why he mistakenly skipped Tachanun as we were approaching Yitzhak Kislev, V'hamevin Yavin. But it was a mistake. But it wasn't a mistake. Okay, good. We're all on the same page here. And that's where we are right now, a time that is very special in the world, and we have to understand why. And of course, as we get much closer to Hanukkah, and we know so much about Hanukkah already, we've learned it from the time about it from the time we were kids. Finding a new angle is difficult. We're not necessarily going to find a new angle. Maybe we'll reveal some ideas, some thoughts that we've heard about that we know, but maybe in a different light, and bring those two ideas of what this day means, Yad Kislev, and what Hanukkah means to us, and how we could use it to enhance our connection to the one above. Okay. So it all starts with a Rambam. The Rambam that I saw mentioned in several different Svarim, Hasidic, and otherwise as the focus of, I wouldn't say controversy, but I would say confusion, at the very least, in terms of how Hanukkah is described. And this is referring to the halacha of the Rambam at the very end of Hilchos Hanukkah, in the last perek, and one of the last halachos. And if we remember, and this is always important to remember when we're reading Mishneh Torah of the Rambam wrote that sefer as a guide for halachic observance. There was one purpose to writing this massive work called the Yad Chazaka, or as we call it, the Mishneh Torah. It was to know what to do, what the psak is for how to observe the Torah. It was actually controversial when it was published because it seemed to make the Gemara unnecessary to learn anymore because now we have this thing. This is before the Shulchan Aruch came out. This is in Middle Ages. And therefore, it wasn't immediately accepted because of how comprehensive it was and how easy it was to just access regular halacha. But it's important to understand that he didn't dance around subjects. He didn't embellish on why things are done and the Kabbalistic underpinning. He just said, this is what you have to do. And therefore, anytime there's a deviation from that, and even in the smallest way, even one word, it's important to try and understand why that happens. And here is a very significant digression from his normal way of speaking, of writing the halachos. In Hilchos Chanukah and Perek Dalet. Mitzvahs ner Chanukah, mitzvah chaviva hi ad mo'od. The mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is a very, very beloved mitzvah. Ad ma'od isn't just very. Ad as if like it's to the furthest extreme of the word very is how beloved the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah is. And he's not just writing that by itself. It's meant to qualify the following statement. V'tzarech adam lihizarba. And we have to be very careful with it. Kedei lehodia hanes, in order to publicize the nes, ulhosif b'sheva chakel v'hodaya lo al hanisim sh'asal lanu, and to increase the amount of praise to God and thanks for the miracles he performed for us, afilu ein lo ma yochal ela min hatzdaka, even if one is so poor that he is living off of charity, eating off of charity, shoel o mocher k'suso v'lokeach shem v'neiros v'madlik, a famous halacha, one must borrow money or even sell the shirt on his back, in order to purchase oil for the candles, in order to do this mitzvah. This is in contrast to the halacha that one must not spend. There are specific halachos of how much money one is allowed to spend on mitzvahs, up to a fifth, up to three-fifths. There are different halachos about this, and here it's so much to the extreme that literally you have to go shirtless if necessary in order to do this mitzvah. And for that reason, it must be, at least on the most basic level, that's why he started by saying, Mitzvah Ner Chanukah, Mitzvah Chaviva, it's so beloved. You want to know how beloved it is? How important it is? You need to even sell the shirt on your back. But the problem is, that first line that's in bold, it's still unnecessary. It doesn't have to do with the halacha. It's telling us about the halacha, about the mitzvah. It seems to be a personal opinion. There's no proof, there's no source for how Neros Chanukah is a mitzvah chaviva ad ma'ot. This is not something that like comes from Tehillim or anything like that. Obviously, this entire holiday came after all of these published works of Torah Sheba'al Peh, so except for Gemara. But there's no source for why Chanukah would be chaviva ad ma'ot. And everyone talks about how this is a very strange thing. On a very simple level, the question is, so what about Shabbos? Shabbos is like, Shabbos is nice. You know, I know it's in the first parsha of the Torah, and everything that we do, every single holiday is really only Zecher, it pales in comparison to Shabbos, and Shabbos is Osi Beinu Vein B'nei Yisrael Osi Li Olam. But Neres Chanukah, Chaviv and Hiyanod. Seems very strange. Not only is that comparison by itself strange, but the very next halacha, which I didn't put in the source sheet, is if you have only one candle or one set of candles, and it's Shabbos Chanukah, and you could either light Neros Shabbos or Neros Chanukah, which one do you pick?
Chanukah.
Shabbos. It was 50-50, sorry. Put everyone on the spot. Shabbos. So wouldn't that seem to contradict this very halacha? Oh, Chanukah, so important. Shirt on your back, just everything you can, do Chanukah. But by the way, if it's Shabbos, chuck it. Because Shabbos is more... So why didn't the Rambam mention anything about Shabbos? How Chaviv... How beloved Shabbos is. So there's something here about Chanukah, and this is where we have to begin our search for what Chanukah is really about. There's something here that obviously is beyond just the simple understanding of what the holiday is, right? For the Rambam to say this is so unbelievably beloved, so he could have said that, you know, everyone knows, everyone has probably seen a rabbi or some sort of speaker who's just extremely passionate, or even just in the non-religious world, someone who's just extremely passionate, someone who writes, there was a person when I was in high school, a friend of mine, who only wrote, back then there was something called AOL Instant Messaging. Every single instant message was in caps and in a different, like, neon color. And that's how they wrote. And I didn't know if they were, like, super excited or if they didn't realize that it was in caps the entire time and they were just, like, you know, relaxed. But every time they were back, like, hi, how are you? It sounded like they were yelling at me from the computer and I could almost hear them, right? So the Rambam could have written this about every single holiday. Could have written Shabbos, Chaviv Hiyanod, oh my gosh, unbelievable. Like Rav Shlomo would talk about Shabbos, right? And Pesach, Chaviv Hiyanod, oh, the beginning of the Jewish people. Shavuos, the giving of the Torah, oh my gosh, Chaviv Hiyanod. And yet, there's something about Chanukah. And my last point, just to make this question as solid as it possibly can. Famously, the Rambam goes out of his way to make it clear in several different areas that there cannot be the notion in our minds that one mitzvah is more important than the other. There is no such concept that I need to do this mitzvah and pay more attention to it and focus on it more carefully, more than other mitzvah, because that mitzvah is more important. Right? There is no such concept. And the Rambam goes out of his way to explain this, lehalacha, by pointing out that when we get to the point in Kriyas HaTorah of Parshas Yisro where we say the Aseres HaDibros, what does everyone in the shul do? Stand up, except for those that hold like the Rambam. Because the Rambam points out no one should stand up during Aseres HaDibros reading, because that would seem to imply that these 10 mitzvos are more important than the other 603 that are written in the Torah when we're all sitting down and reading along. Why are we standing up for these 10 and not for those? And he says, lahalacha, you can't stand up. You shouldn't stand up because that would seem to imply that 10 are important than the others. Now, it's a good question then, what is it? What were the Aseres HaDibros about? But that's for a different time. But he clearly has, and again, this translates into halacha lemaisa, according to the Rambam, clearly has a halachic opinion that no one mitzvah should be considered greater or more important than any other. And yet, we come back to this halacha where it's ad ma'od. Go as far as you can go to do this mitzvah. Fine. So I'm not sure how I'm going to use the makoros here. They're just kind of here because I was thinking about this stuff. It could be I'll read some of it inside, some of it outside, but I think... You know, the Torah of Yad Kislev, the Torah of Chanukah, is that it's not all about the black and white words on the paper. It's about what's beyond that. So maybe in that spirit, I will kind of dance around with inside the source sheet and outside. So let's take a step back and move to Yad Kislev for a while. Yad Kislev, Yud Tes Kislev, is the birthday, so to speak, of Hasidus. Not that Chassidus began there, it began with the Baal Shem Tov, but the Baal HaTanya was the one that basically was responsible for spreading it to his students and eventually really across that entire region and ultimately around the entire world. And as we know, the Chabad dynasty eventually became the owners of spreading Judaism to every corner of the earth, and that is not a coincidence. It started with the Baal HaTanya spreading Chassidus to all throughout the region of Eastern Europe, and then it got to the 70s, 80s, 90s, where the last Lubavitcher Rebbe was telling his Chassidim, spread it to the entire world. So what's the idea of spreading Chassidus to the entire world? Why is it being spread to the entire world now and not 200 years before, or then, and not 200 years before that or 2,000 years before that? Why was there such a notion of Chassidus at that time when it wasn't such a notion until then? And what are we supposed to take from this special day for ourselves? So it's important to first think about the history of the time. I was a Jewish history major in a college, and I took a couple. And I took a couple of classes, one called Modern Jewish History, which covered the birth and the development of Chassidus, and another called Lithuanian Jewish History, which is famously not where Chassidus became popular. Yet, Chabad Chassidus is actually, there were several different sects of Chassidus that did originate in Lithuania. Gur and Kutsk and Izhvitz, that dynasty is a Lithuanian dynasty, one that was more closely associated with in-depth learning as opposed to others. I won't go into it now, but it helped me have a greater appreciation for not just the timeline of when, you know, what's the birthday of Chassidus and what has happened until then, but why it happened right then. So there are a couple of important things to understand about the 1700s in Eastern Europe. This is not necessarily unique to the 1700s, but it's definitely what was going on then. Jews, rough time in their life. Pogroms, we've heard of these things. Rights were not given to Jews. If there is discrimination and persecution, it means you're not living a comfortable life, even if you have money. But if you don't have rights, so then you're probably not given opportunities to get jobs, to get an education, to get any sort of networking, connections, anything like that. You were the bottom of the totem pole. And if you didn't have any opportunities, you didn't have the ability to gain resources. People simply weren't able to amass wealth and amass power and amass influence. And if you didn't have resources, then you couldn't get an education. Because unlike now, where education is relative to the rest of history, very accessible, you weren't able to get even a basic education unless you had the resources to do that, unless you had money, and you didn't need to, at the age of 6 years old, start working in your parents' field or in the family business in order to simply keep food on the table. Lack of education. That meant the average Jew was uneducated. I mean, the average Jew knew more about a horse than about the Parsha, the average Jew. What happened to Torah learning was that it was reserved, and this is actually the same way for many centuries, but this was kind of the culmination of this. It was reserved for the people that had privilege, that had influence, that had power, that had money. Why? Because they could support a child who was able to learn Torah and not need to work, because they could give that child an education and even recognize if that child was gifted in the world of Torah learning, and therefore say, hey, I want this kid to continue learning. But if a kid never even opened up a book and was in the field the whole time, it could be that he was a math genius, kind of a, was the Matt Damon movie again? Oh my gosh. Good Will Hunting style, right? You never know if he's a genius or not because he's a janitor. And he could always be a janitor, and you never know because he never had the resources, he never had the ability to even give him a shot. And what happened in the Lithuanian world, the non-Hasidic world, was that there were yeshivas. The famous yeshiva that started was Volozhin in the late 1700s by Rav Chaim Volozhin, who was one of the chief students of the Vilna Gaon. And what happened was the people that went there were people that were gifted. And at a certain point, if you were learning Torah for several years, then there was a decision that had to be made, usually in your teenage years, whether you were going to continue to learn Torah, or you would have to stop and learn a trade because someone had to pay for your life. And the question was, if you were gifted enough, if you were successful enough in learning, then there would be an attempt to raise money to sponsor your learning. Or what often happened at the time, and don't judge because it was a different time back then, you could get married at 13 or 14 years old to someone's daughter, and that person had a lot of money, and they considered it a privilege to support their new son-in-law in learning until he turned 18, 19, 20. And by then, if he's been learning that long, we're not talking about just a regular 20-year-old entering Shana Aleph. We're talking about someone who may have finished Shas and who may be able to publish his own writings. That lifestyle led to simply a Torah lifestyle. But if at 13, 14, 15, he was an okay student, it wasn't easy to sponsor someone their entire life, or at least their entire adolescence, pay for everything, all their expenses to learn Torah if they weren't seeing an all-star coming out of this. So they would basically say, okay, instead of learning now, we decided you're going to make shoes. And that's their life. And they don't have the ability to learn Torah anymore. And whatever they learned, they learned. And maybe they could catch bits and pieces of things here and there when a rabbi comes through town. But that's their life. There's a famous story of the Netziv. Famous story of the Netziv. Sorry, for people who don't know it. You could hear about it now for the first time. It's also okay. Where he was learning, and he was an average student. He was doing okay, some days better than others. And the Netziv being Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who had two sons, one named Rav Chaim Berlin and one named Rav Meir Berlin, who changed his name to Bar Ilan, his last name, and he was a Zionist, and he came here, and then there was a university that was named after him. And he was upstairs, and his parents were kind of arguing downstairs, and he was at the top of the stairwell, and they were arguing with the teacher, with Naftali Tzvi Yehuda's teacher, and they were saying, I don't know, we really think he could do it. And the teacher said, I don't know, he's not as strong as the other students. Maybe you should start teaching him a trade so he can make money. He can make a living for himself. And at the end of the conversation, they kind of decided, okay, that's what we're going to do. And he said, I'm not going to let that happen. And he dedicated the next years of his life to learning with intensity and with passion, and he became the Rosh Yeshiva of that Yeshiva of Volozh. But that was the way of life. It was a very clear-cut decision. You were either in the club or out, and there was really no middle ground, like going to a Daf Yomi Shir. There was that lifestyle didn't exist. And that means there was just a lot of people that didn't feel any connection. They didn't have the opportunity to feel any connection to Judaism. And there is this massive section of Jews, the majority of them, that knew Judaism, maybe knew mitzvos from their parents, seeing it at home, maybe knew little bits and pieces of Divrei Torah, but that was it. And they knew more about farming and agriculture than they knew about Parsha. And there were really that issue, coupled with the fact that there was just tremendous persecution, anti-Semitism against the Jews, meant it wasn't such a good thing to be a Jew. I didn't feel anything special about being Jewish, and I was being murdered or enslaved or sent to a Russian army or kidnapped just for being a Jew. So where's the upside? Where's the good part about this? And that's the world, the climate in which Hasidus was born. And it was essentially addressing those two issues. The issues of there is something special about Judaism. There is something about being Am HaNifchar, about being Banim Atem LaShem. It's not just now that you have a yellow star, people are going to run after you and kill you in the streets. And not only that, not just the fact that you're inherently special, but even you, lowly farmer, dirty guy who never learned the Aleph Beis in day school, you can have this unbelievably special connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with Hashem. And you didn't need to go to yeshiva, you didn't need to marry some rich guy's daughter. You didn't need to have a privileged life in order to connect to God. You're not out of the club just because you didn't get born into a wealthy family, anywhere you are, anyone you are, regardless of the circumstance, you have this amazing ability to connect to Hashem. And that is Chassidus. The mitzvos weren't lacking. You could still do mitzvos. That existed before Chassidus started. It wasn't a matter of doing. It was a matter of belonging, of connecting. Do you see the difference? People may have learned what it means to be a Jew in terms of what you do. They saw what it meant to keep Shabbos in their house. There are obviously varying degrees. But the basics, even uneducated people knew. That was something that was easy enough to pass down. What was hard to pass down? The depth. The stuff that you needed time, that you needed special circumstances in order to learn with a special teacher and have the ability to let it resonate and deepen your experience. The idea of going away to yeshiva for a year, and then it was 5, 6, 7 years, and being surrounded by the spiritual environment, that's something they lacked. And what Chassidus addressed was that depth. Even you, even the lowest person on earth, could achieve a deep, meaningful relationship and passionate relationship with God. So the Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson, in source number 3, mentions that what Chassidus, the significance of Chassidus, which is the revealing of deeper Torahs, the revealing of the secrets of Torah, of what lies underneath, of achieving that deeper connection beyond just the words and the actions, but the feeling. So it really came from, or the reasons why it was brought about now were really basically split into two different reasons. In source number 3, in the column on the right-hand side, you'll see the middle paragraph, Aval bedoros ha'achronim mitzvah legalos zos ha'chochma. It's a mitzvah to reveal these inner secrets, the deeper wisdom of the Torah, whereas until that point, it was not only not a mitzvah, but it was meant to be reserved for people who were already knowledgeable, who had already achieved a certain level of scholarship. Yes?
The way you portray has to sound like a good thing. At the same time, the Vilna Gaon and the whole Lishtishe community were against it.
Yes.
My question is, how come?
How come they were against it?
Yes.
Believe neither, I'll get to it. If I don't, raise your hand again and ask me. Okay? So here are the two reasons. Number one, Aleph. Al derech mashakasav haraman b'psicha l'svar mor nevuchim shehatam shakasav sifrozeh. What's the reason why the Rambam wrote mor nevuchim? What does the words mor nevuchim mean? The famous title of mor nevuchim, Guide to the Perplexed. So what was he writing? And by the way, the Mor Nevuchim was also a very controversial book that people said don't really read if you didn't learn other stuff first, because this has lots of deep secrets that you shouldn't just pick up from day one. He was writing a sefer for people that didn't understand the philosophy of Judaism, and he was pouring on all the philosophy of Judaism, but he made it accessible to even people who didn't learn the Aleph Beis yet. Which sounds like kind of like what happened with Chassidus. People who don't know the Aleph Beis are learning deep secrets of Torah and of Jewish philosophy. So why does the Rambam himself say that he wrote this book? Shatam shekasav sifro zeh sheyesh bo inyanim nistarim hu amram bekamo zeh ha'inyan. Just like this idea of Chassidus, eis lasas Hashem heferus orasecha. This is a time that we must act for God, and we could go against some of the rules that are outlined in the Torah when it's for the sake of God. When the Jewish people are in a situation of perplexed, that is when he decided to reveal these deeper Torahs, these deeper ideas, in order to save them from being lost completely. They were confused. They may have been influenced by negative philosophical arguments against Judaism, and if they were going to be saved, it wasn't going to be through, well, just do what the Torah says. That wasn't going to work anymore. They needed to taste what it really was about. They needed to see some of the deep, dark secrets of Judaism in a good way. the ones that reveal the beauty and the depth and the passion of Judaism, and that was the way to save them. And it is that same direction, that same approach regarding revealing the pnimius, the inner depths of the Torah in these later generations. Shezehu begeder es lasus Hashem efiris orsecha. It is an urgent time. Godel hayirida shel hadoros achronim, the amount we are plunging in terms of the generations, in terms of their connection, in terms of their understanding. Shenismatu halavovos, and specifically not just our understanding, but our connection, our feeling, closeness to Torah and to mitzvos and to Hashem has decreased significantly in the later generations. V'chein mitzan matzav ha'olam b'chol luso. Shahara bedoros eile hu bizgavris yisera. And not just in the Jewish hearts and minds, but the world itself has simply become a darker, more evil place. Mahava hechrich rav legalis osachachma. And to fight against that, there is a great need to reveal this deep wisdom. Pnimius ha-Torah shim me'oreris es ha-kochos ha-pnimim ha-nestarim shebenishmas ha-adam. Hanosnum lo ezer v'siyo lesgabar al-cheshkas ha-golos. These deep Torahs, these deep ideas that are at the heart of what Judaism really is, are meant to give people who are fighting against the deepest, the darkest and strongest evil in the world, to give them strength to overcome that darkness of exile. And not only the darkness of exile on the outside, but on the inside also. The doubt, the confusion that we feel, the influence that we have is not only on the outside, but when we grow up with certain influences, it's on the inside also. That we don't feel comfortable with some of the ideas found in the Torah. That we feel like, well, if Judaism is really right, then why isn't it so clear, had so much more accurate and real than the other religions? These types of questions, which are, by the way, okay to ask, because we need to know the answers. But what the Rebbe is saying is that this is how we answer these questions, by accessing the deep, the depths of Torah and the pnimius that is found in Chassidus. That is the first reasoning for revealing Chassidus at this time, because of the great yirida that our generations have gone through, and because of the amount of negative influences that are around us and within us, we need to combat that with something much more significant than what we have had until now. Beis, matzinu kama enyanim shebaim b'tur hachana limos ha-mashiach. This is also, there are several ideas about how we need to prepare for the days of Mashiach. U'b'lashon aram li'asher Yisrael l'hachan libam. To straighten out the Jewish people and to prepare their hearts. Limos ha-mashiach. U'kol shekein v'kal v'chomer shekein tzorech lom v'rin ogeh l'inyanim ha'ikari shal limos ha-mashiach. When Yimos HaMashiach come, it's going to be a time of pure godliness. The entire world will simply be striving to connect to God, and if it just hits us without us being prepared for it, without us understanding what that means, we simply won't be able to handle it. We won't be able to appreciate and take advantage of the Yimos HaMashiach the way it should be. And therefore, in the generations before Mashiach, which, by the way, we're very much in right now, it is not only an opportunity, but it is our responsibility to prepare ourselves. And I don't mean like doing push-ups, but I mean our hearts. To prepare our hearts to deepen ourselves to the day that we see God with our own two eyes, to appreciate what that means. And if we see it without ever knowing what God even was to begin with, we might not even catch what we're seeing. We might not appreciate it. And that's what Chassidus is for. At this time and age. So we mentioned that when Chassidus began to spread across Eastern Europe and eventually into Western Europe, it was opposed by other groups of Orthodox Jews, observant Jews. They became a group called the Misnagdim. They are called Misnagdim because they are neged. They are those that are against. Now, that doesn't really define who they are. It simply defines them in relation to the Hasidim. But they are simply Lithuanian Jewry. Lithuanian Jewry, which is responsible for the yeshiva-style form of learning Torah, where the concentration on learning Torah observance, as well as the depth of Torah study through Torah Sheval Peh, Mishnah, Gemara, commentaries, is the central part of Torah, of a Torah lifestyle. And everything else basically forms a nice picture around that one center, which is the study of Torah. And therefore, the ideas of focusing on the beauty of Shabbos, or spending 3 hours a day davening Shacharis as opposed to 47 minutes on a good day, is contrary to this belief system, where if you're davening for 3 hours, you just spent 2 hours that you could have been learning Torah going like this without even saying anything. You were just wasting time. You could have been staring at a wall for those 2 hours. You didn't just increase your connection to God there. You could have been learning Torah for 2 hours. Now, that's just a small glimpse of the conflict that took place. But Hasidus really, I wouldn't say they took the focus away from learning Torah, but they, I think, widened the circle by which you can say committed, observant Jews live in. And it meant the feeling connected to Judaism was not only just as important as the actual observance and the actual learning and the actual doing, but it was more important. And that became the focus. Not necessarily at the expense of the learning, but certainly that the opposite couldn't exist. If you were learning Torah, but you weren't connecting more and more to God through that learning Torah process, then just chuck it. Just don't do it, because you're not achieving the intended goal. And that was the philosophy. And if you're not educated enough, and if you don't have the privilege of learning Torah all day, so then what? You're out of the club? No. Go to a tish. Go learn the one parak of Tehillim that you learned your entire life. Say it over and over. If that gets you more and more connected, more and more passionate about God, so then you're doing exactly the same thing as the guy learning three siddurim of Gemara a day is doing in terms of the intended goal. There's a famous, it's not a story because it's a lack of a story, but famously the Vilna Gaon, the Balatanya, or Shneur Zalman Meliadi, wanted to meet with the Vilna Gaon. They lived at the same time. The Vilna Gaon being the father of the Misnagdim, so to speak, Lithuanian Jewry, and the Balatanya being the father of Hasidus at the time, and he wanted to meet, and the Vilna Gaon refused to meet him. And they never ended up meeting. And people wondered what exactly was the reason why they never met. And the Balatanya was ready to meet him, but the Vilna Gaon never met. And people had all these theories about why it never happened. But the one that everyone is well known is that there were irreconcilable differences of opinion in terms of Hashkafic view, in terms of their outlook on Jewish observance, that the Vilna Gaon said, I can't sit with this person because I have such a different, it's an interesting thing, how different the same exact thing came to be. And without necessarily going too much into the specific reasons why the Misnagdim opposed Hasidus, because we can probably spend the whole semester course on the origins and the philosophy of Hasidus and how it relates to the other, right? The other forms of Jewish observance. I would just say, based on what we were just explaining a second ago, that the focus was on the passion. The focus was on the relationship. The word that Hasidus really harps on is dveikut, dveikus, which literally means an incredibly strong, deep, intimate connection with God. And when we're talking about an incredibly strong, deep connection with God, we're talking about 613 different ways of doing that, and not one called learning Torah. And when we're talking about a demographic that feels like Judaism is worthless and meaningless, so then this addresses those needs, because even if you attach yourself to one mitzvah and that brings you to this incredibly intimate connection with God, then you are doing what Hashem wants you to do. And even if you're on a farm and cutting wheat in a field is what's getting you closer to Hashem, and there are all these, that's why stories are used, and that's why personalities are highlighted so much in terms of Chassidus, because the goal is to be inspired, to be passionate. And there are all sorts of famous stories that highlight this. There's one story that I'll mention before we continue, is that a Rebbe was once, I forget which one, was having a tish. All of his Chassidim around. The Rebbe was, he was the biggest celebrity in town. That's what he was. He was the person by which you have direct access to a spiritual experience and to God himself. Everyone was packed into the room, an amazing experience, and the back door flies open. No one even hears that someone's in the back because there's singing and dancing and all of that. And there's this dirty guy in like one of those overall things. And he starts pushing his way all the way to the front. He's like, I need to see the Rebbe. I need to see the Rebbe. Let me go. Let me go. Now, no one just like decided that they could go see the Rebbe. That wasn't something you did. You were invited, you requested, and you waited for when you were told you can see the Rebbe. But this person pushed his way all the way up to the front, and it was kind of too fast for people to stop him, and he got all the way up to the Rebbe, and he stopped the tish, and said, Rebbe, it's an emergency, I have a question. People were startled. They thought maybe something's really going wrong. Maybe there really is an emergency. And he said, Rebbe, my horse, he won't eat the food that I gave him. What do I give my horse? And the Rebbe took his hand and he looked at him and he said, try feeding your horse some hay. And he's like, oh, thank you so much. Oh, Rebbe, thank you so much. Oh, okay, I'm going to... And he runs out and everyone's like, what? But he was out of there fast enough that people could forget that just happened. And the singing resumed, and they were handing out potato kugel by hand and everything like that. 15 minutes later, door swings open. And now people are like, wait, I remember that noise from 15 minutes ago. Guy pushing his way through, people are like, what's going on? They were like kind of holding him back, but he was way too committed to getting there. And they're like, okay, we'll give him one more shot. And he goes in there, he's like, I have a problem, like, my cow, he's none of the milk's coming out. He's like, try milking the cow. But he's looking him straight in the eye and he's like, you know, try milking the cow. He's like, oh, thank you so much. And he left. The third time, door swings open, everyone turns around, they lock arms, you're like, you ain't getting through. It's not happening. And he was like jumping up, he was like trying to get, Rebbe, I need you. And the Rebbe noticed that the guy was back and they weren't letting him through, and he stopped the tish and he said, bring him to the front. And everyone's like, what? I don't get it. Why is the Rebbe even wasting time with this guy? He's insane. He's literally insane. He's a farmer and doesn't know how to milk a cow. It's one thing if a yeshiva bacher came and he said, I don't know how to milk a cow, fine. And he comes in and he's like, my goats. And he answers him, okay, just, you know, put them in a field. Let them eat grass, they'll be great. He's like, oh, thank you, Rebbe. And the Chassidim are like, okay, you have to explain what's going on here, Rebbe. Something's going on, what's going on? And he looked at his Chassidim with kind of like confusion, as if like they should have understood what was happening in front of their eyes, and they couldn't, and it was so clear to him. And he said, you know, Chevra, this man is a farmer. He doesn't know what a tish is. He doesn't know even what davening is. He doesn't know what it means to connect to Hashem. There's only one thing he knows, which is that there's a rabbi in the front of the shul on Friday night who is very holy and very spiritual, and he can somehow connect you to God. And this man had nothing spiritual in his life that he could use to even approach me to connect to God with. He literally had nothing. The only thing he knew was cows and goats and hay and grass. That was his entire life. He was so empty of godliness. But he so much wanted to connect that he had to figure out some way to approach the Rebbe and try and connect in some way. So he brought a farming problem. It might not have even been a real problem. But he pushed his way all the way to the Rebbe, and this was the most spiritual moment that he ever had, asking the Rebbe, there's no milk coming out of the cows. He said, that was equal to whatever singing we just did for 2 hours. This one person had his entire tish in those couple of minutes. So the beautiful idea there is that there's no such thing as, you know, if you got the education, if you grew up here, if you're part of this special elite club and you wear this size shtreimel and you go to that shul and you do, then you can, then you're in. But otherwise, like, sorry, you missed it. You know, maybe in your next Gilgal or something like that, but not this one. But what the idea of Chassidus was is it's in all of you. It's in all of you, and it doesn't matter where or who or how. Yes?
Why did he have to come in 4 times then?
He couldn't stop. He wanted to keep going. No, there was no significance to the number. No, there was no significance. That I at least the way the story was, the story was not told in any way that 3 was a significant. Could be. There you go. And just to get the image right in our head of what we're talking about here in terms of Chassidus before we go back to Hanukkah. We're talking about depth of understanding of the inner secrets of Torah. But we're talking about making that depth accessible to even the most common person in the world of the Jewish people. And we're talking about the intended goal of those two things, common man, deep secrets, essence of the Torah, equals passionate relationship with God. Passionate, loving, meaningful, intimate relationship with God. One that the other side, so to speak, had this class system where if you were meant to learn Torah, if you were gifted, then you had the opportunity to achieve this very close relationship with God. Otherwise, put on tefillin every day, you know, read the 2 books that exist in your house, and make shoes. And don't worry, because at least you're not being killed, right? But that's your connection to God. And the Chassidus said that's not how it's meant to be. That's not how Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted his children to live. That you either have it or you don't. You're a have or you're a have not. Everyone is a have. Everyone should have the ability to connect. And it shouldn't be within, obviously within the rules of the Torah, but it shouldn't be within the rules set by society or set by background or social status. Those are not rules by which Jews need to play in terms of how much they could connect to God. We already have been given the rules by which we could connect to God. Let's use them. So what's Hanukkah about? Hanukkah was at a very interesting time. Sometimes, maybe earlier in life, people make the mistake to think that the holiday of Purim came after the holiday of Hanukkah chronologically, but it didn't happen that way, even though it happened in the calendar year later. Hanukkah was the last holiday established as a national holiday of the Jewish people, national religious holiday. It was towards the end of the Second Temple period, around 200 years before the Second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. It was a period of time where there was a nice degree of separation among the Jewish people. Jews were separated into different sects with different behaviors and different lifestyles. There was some degree of corruption even. The Kohen Gadol position was being auctioned off every year as opposed to being handed down through lineage as it should have been. There was a lot of fighting within the Jewish people, as famously was recorded the reason why the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed. And then there come these people called the Greeks, who came in with a lot of philosophy, based on logic and reason, with a lot of art, with a lot of beauty, with a lot of worshiping the human being. And they came to bring down Judaism. What does it say in the song that we sing? Yevanim nikbitzu alai, azai bimei chashmanim. The Greeks gathered against me at the times of the chashmanim. Ufartzu chomos migdalai, and they breached the walls of our tower, the Beis Hamikdash. V'timu kol hashmanim, and they impurified the oil, referring to the oil that was used for the menorah. And one of the interesting things about this holiday, number one, it was the last miracle that was performed for the Jewish people. That was the last open miracle that we ever saw as a people. This is the last one. And it was at a time where, even though we weren't in exile, it kind of felt like it. It was extreme confusion within the Jewish people. It was an extremely unspiritual time. It was a time where the Beis HaMikdash was around, but it wasn't in service. It was out of order. It was a time where it was hard to feel a very strong connection to the Jewish people, because if you looked with your own two eyes and you saw what the Jewish people were about, you didn't see a nice picture at all. You saw fighting, you saw confusion, you saw people that were jumping to the other side, called Mityavnim, the Hellenistic Jews. They were more fascinated and enthralled in the culture of Greece than in Jewish culture. And there was a real serious question of what's Judaism about. And we're talking about a time where Jews are in Israel with the Beis HaMikdash around, people asking, like, why am I a Jew? And the whole idea of Greece, of the Greeks at that time, wasn't to kill the Jews, which is essentially every other story in Jewish history. It wasn't to kill us. It was v'timu kol hashmanim. Keep your oil. Keep your menorah. We're not going to steal it. We're just going to make it impure. Don't have some pure thing that's very special, that's only for you, that's not for us. Don't consider yourself on this higher level, this deeper understanding, this deeper connection, this passion that doesn't exist in other places. No, you're just like us. You're human. You bleed. You get dirty also. You're not this clean, pure, elevated people. And that culture and that feeling definitely got through to many of the Jews, who felt, okay, Judaism isn't so special. Greek culture is unbelievable. The Aristotle is an unbelievable philosophy, unbelievable art and culture, which has been carried on way past the Greek people to this very day. And then there needed to be, to combat that, this movement, even if it was really small and didn't pick up so much, it wasn't so popular or trendy, of restoring the passion in Judaism again. Saying you don't need to be the Kohen Gadol to be the closest to God. And just doing mitzvos and then going home and having the rest of your Greek life doesn't mean that you were yotzei, doesn't mean that you did it right. If you're doing it right, it means you have a passionate, intimate connection with God. And if you're not doing it with that, if that element is missing, then you're not doing it right. And what the Greeks basically said is, you could do most of the mitzvos. They only outlawed a few. Shabbos, Bris Milah, Rosh Chodesh, those are the famous ones they outlawed. And there are reasons why they outlawed them. You could do pretty much all of your Jewish life. Just, we're going to take away all meaning from it. We're going to suck the passion out of it. We're going to take everything special from it and bury it, and all you have is just the 610 mitzvos that you do. And that's what the small family of Kohanim that said, we're going to wage a war, literally at the expense of our own life, because like I've said in previous shiurim in different places, when a family sits around the dinner table and decides, tomorrow we're going to fight a war against the military, it usually means that they assume, they understand they're going to die, right? So these people were giving up their lives when their lives were not in danger for the sole purpose of making a statement that a passion, if Judaism exists without passion, then it is not Judaism. And it is a strange thing if people were living in peace, relative peace, and then seeing these people fighting and dying for something, they probably felt it will probably make some noise. And it will probably, hopefully, raise people's awareness of how Judaism is much more than just the routine. It's not just for the people who are able to serve in the Beit HaMikdash, and if you just live in a random suburb in Israel, it's not really for you. Judaism is meant to be passion for every single person. We're meant to be on fire, we're meant to be alive, there's meant to be warmth and kindness and light. And without that, then we're not in this world anymore. It's not worth it. And what happened, obviously, was that God saw this message and said, this is exactly what the world needs. And not only will, and not just that you'll die for this message, but you'll live for this message. And I will make you win the war on this message. And famously, the miracle of the oil, you may not know this, was a miracle that was unnecessary. Oil in the Beis HaMikdash used for the menorah, there is a famous halacha that if you have something that is impure, if it's for the sake of a communal mitzvah, it is allowed to be used. It's called Tumah Hutra Bitzibura. If you need to do a mitzvah that is a communal mitzvah, not an individual mitzvah, you can use something that is impure. And therefore, all the impure oil that they had in the Beis HaMikdash, which I'm sure was gallons of it, was allowed to be used for the mitzvah. And therefore, if there was no miracle performed at that time, and they looked and they said, oh no, there's only one jug of pure oil, the guy next to them said, no worries, halacha says we're allowed to use it all. And he was right. Except the whole idea of Hanukkah was, I'm not just going to do it. That's what we've been doing until now. No one's been stopping us from just doing it. I want to live it. I want to feel like I want to do it right. I want to feel like this is my connection to God, so I don't just want to mail it in. There's a famous story of a man who was married for around 5-6 years and felt like the passion in his marriage was kind of dying out. And he wanted to reignite the spark in his marriage, so he went to his local rabbi for some relationship advice. And he said, you know, what can I do to spice up my marriage again? I kind of feel like it's burning out. And he said, very simple. Every week, on Friday, when you come home from work, make sure you stop and get one rose for your wife. It will be such a beautiful gesture. Roses are beautiful. She'll see that you went out of your way to get her the flower. Perfect. The guy's like, well, that's it. Great. Sounds pretty simple, not too expensive. Next Friday, he comes home, knocks on the door, wife opens up, and he's holding 54 roses. And he says, honey, I just want to tell you how much I love you. I'm putting these roses in the broom over there. Every Friday, I want you to take one of those roses, because I love you so much. And he thought, okay, perfect. And the idea being, when you're passionate about something, it's not about really what you've accomplished, because that's not the goal, the accomplishment really. The goal is the relationship. And what you do, the effort you put in, and the amount of emotional involvement you have in what you're doing is really what builds that relationship, and it's less about where you go on the date, but how you enjoy yourself on the date. And that's what Hasidus is about. That's what was dying in Judaism at the time, where people were either learning Torah and then going and smoking on Shabbos, which was a historical fact in many of the yeshivas. The people who were still committed to Torah, the passion was still leaving. And those are only the people, the 1% of the people that were learning Torah all day. And then there's the other 99% of the people who didn't even have a connection at all because they were making shoes all day. So where is the passion? It wasn't there. Hanukkah was a time of such darkness, such confusion, even without the Greeks. The Jewish people were like, whoa, what is going on here? This guy Jesus? Who's that guy? That's craziness what he's talking about. He actually didn't say anything, but whatever. All of this weird, what is Judaism? I don't get it. I don't even connect to it anymore. I have doubts about it. I know it's been around for centuries, but I don't understand it. And then there's this whole Greek thing, which sounds really awesome and trendy. There needs to be passion again. Yes?
Matthew, if the Quran in the
Maccabees,
were so passionate about doing like we, also with the oil, they went out of the way to do it correctly with the tahor.
Sure.
How come then they took the leadership, which is supposed to be only for the...
It's another shir. I saw a nice Shemi Shmuel about that. Read in the Shemi Shmuel and answer that question I never heard before. How come, and maybe the Rebbe also about it. But it's a good question. They took the Malchus, which is meant to be just for Yehuda, and it's a very good question. Because it seems the Chazal say they were punished for that. 200 years later, they were all killed and based on the English was destroyed. It's a good question. I'm going to leave it for now. But it brings us back to our final point, which is where we started, which is this weird, cryptic, confusing Rambam who calls the mitzvah of Chanukah, of Neros Chanukah, a mitzvah that is beloved to the furthest extreme. And then a Siva Shalom, and I can only say it outside, but you can look at it inside, says it's not just that the mitzvah is so beloved, but that the mitzvah is about how beloved the mitzvah is. Did I explain that correctly? As opposed to other mitzvahs where you do them, and the point is that you do them, and yes, there are varying degrees of how passionate you are about it, but as long as you do it, then you did it. How ironic would it be if you mailed in mitzvahs Ner Chanukah? If you just like lighter up to a candle and then walked away. When the whole miracle of Chanukah was about people who wanted to rejuvenate their relationship with God, and they didn't need to, they simply could have gone around along in their normal life, doing everything the same way, more or less. Some difficult things here and there, but who doesn't have struggles in their life? They didn't need any miracles. They weren't being murdered. And the whole holiday was established because of people that said, I want a passionate existence or I want no existence at all. And for us to go into the holiday of Chanukah saying, oh, when do I have to light Chanukah? Okay, I'll squeeze it into my 2-minute break and then I'll just go to the concert or go to whatever it is. By the way, you should go to concerts. That's Hainuach, it's part of the mitzvah. I mean, like, good concerts. Kanye already left, so we don't need to worry. Yeah. To squeeze in the nearest Chanukah and to think like, well, you know, let me buy like the 36 candles that I got for free in the mail, because great, now I don't have to spend any money on it. And let me, you know, squeeze it into the 5 minutes before, when I come in and I go out, and then I'll just say the mitzvah and I'll blow them out because I don't want anything to burn down, and I'll leave. What have we done exactly? Because it's not a mitzvah that God commanded us to do. This is a mitzvah that was brought about by human emotion, by passion, and it's a mitzvah that is perpetuated by that same passion. And therefore, this is the time where there's extra coldness in the world, where there's extra darkness, where we need to be actively putting on our winter coats and actively turning on the lights and actively staying warm and not just assuming that it'll be there and that, you know, whatever, at some point I'll get inspired. Maybe if something comes around and I'm not doing anything, so maybe I'll show up. But then the idea of Neros Chanukah is sell the shirt on your back, because if you're not getting what Chanukah is about, Chaviva, Mitzvah Chaviva Ad Ma'od, then just don't do it. Just don't do it. It's not, the holiday shouldn't have existed if we're going to treat it like any other mitzvah that we have to do regardless. This mitzvah we didn't have to do, but we did it because we cared. Chassidus didn't need to exist. People were doing mitzvahs for the most part. Some learn Torah more than others, the same way in every other generation. And by the way, in the generation of the Talmud, of the Gemara, it was also the top 1% learning Torah, and everyone else was an ignoramus. No different. But there came a time in previous recent generations, or it's that enough is enough. If we're not living a passionate, connected existence, then we're not existing. We're not alive. We may be living, but we're not alive. Hayno hach, it's the same idea. And it's only 6 days apart. This is a holiday that I usually don't mention these types of personal things, but there's a friend of mine named Chaim Feigenbaum, Alav HaShalom, Chaim Yisachar ben Rabbi Chiel Zedel Dov. He passed away a few years ago, unfortunately, from leukemia. One of my closest best friends. He was a big goofball. And he was very Hasidic in nature. And I remember very clearly in Yeshiva University, I basically was living with him. We were going to a lot of the same classes together. So when Hanukkah comes out, it kind of doesn't work out with your schedule. Hanukkah light, candle lighting kind of, I think it was 1 year right in the beginning of English Comp 1, English composition. And it was this new teacher who was really passionate about doing her thing and like didn't want anyone to come late. And we all were kids that wanted to be good kids and do attendance on time and everything. So we all did our candle lighting, and we waited there maybe a few minutes, and we told the teacher, you know, we're going to be a few minutes late this week because there's candle lighting. She understood. She was actually Jewish. She's not observant. And then Chaim would walk in like 40 minutes late. And it wasn't necessarily only because it was a great excuse to walk in 40 minutes late, which it was. But he stayed with, he lit the candles. He said every perek of everything that you could find after lighting candles. And he would sing, even to the point where people like looked at him like, why are you standing by yourself in front of the candles? And everyone like went to class. And he would sing Ana B'Koach. He would sing different Shir Malos. And he would walk into class 40 minutes late, and he's like, sorry, I was lighting candles. And he's like, everyone was lighting candles. He's like, and we were like, he's a big goofball, so you know, like, but he was serious about it. And he always saw that it was very clear that this was his favorite holiday. It was well known by his friends that this is his favorite holiday. And it was fitting because it wasn't about being Yotze. It wasn't about like, oh, can I catch Mincha? Or, you know, make sure I did it right as long, you know, and that occupies all of my mind. But it's about feeling connected, even if it takes a little more time, even if it's not what everyone else is doing. If I'm not finding this meaningful, then why am I doing it? And I say it to a lot of students in gap year programs, especially there's a 1 year program here at Bar Ilan. I teach a lot of the guys. I tell them, especially those that feel very distant from Judaism, and for good reason. They don't necessarily have a strong background, never necessarily had any positive experiences. And I say, if you're a male Jew, then you're not going to get this stink off for the rest of your life. It's you. You're Jewish. Like, that's not changing. So if you're Jewish, like, see if this is something that you could be passionate about. If you already concluded that it's not for you, first make sure that you've done your research and try and find out what it's about. Try and you know, get your feet wet a little, and then make your decision. And I think that's what Hanukkah is about. It's not about writing off Judaism or thinking we know what it is, or seeing Judaism as the do's and don'ts, but it's seeing that there's a world beyond that. And I hope this year, this week, next week, we'll look with a fresh set of eyes at Hanukkah, and at our own lives, at our own spiritual lives, and try and look for ways to rejuvenate ourselves and to really challenge ourselves to say if what I'm doing every day, or even specific things in the day, whether it's one of the three davenings, whether it's just Shabbos, whatever it is, and say if I'm not doing this passionately, then how can I do it more passionately? Because if it has no meaning to me, then why am I doing this? And hopefully the answer won't be, therefore I shouldn't do it at all. Hopefully the answer is, I got to look in a book. I got to go to a shir. I got to go to a concert. I got to sit with the lights off, looking at some candles, and just thinking. So maybe we'd be zocha to think a little, to feel a little more, to bring in the light of Hanukkah this year and bring a little more passion into our lives. And hopefully, as the Rebbe said, we'll usher in, as we are in the last generation before Mashiach, we'll usher in the Mashiach with the ultimate light in the world that will never go out. B'mehir b'yameinu.